court, Your Honors. I'll be reserving 2 minutes of time for my rebuttal. I'm representing the United States in this matter. Your Honors, the affiant for the search warrant in this case, Metropolitan Police Officer Brian Holland, did not act with reckless disregard for the truth when making the averments in his affidavit. Moreover, there was probable cause to search the defendant's residence for drugs and drug paraphernalia. Addressing the four statements that the district court found to be false, I would just note that the district court found three of the statements to be false. The third statement, which I would characterize as an opinion, the district court never actually said that she had found it to be false, but nonetheless, we, for our analysis, are addressing all four statements. This court, in determining whether that finding of reckless disregard for the truth, must apply the governing standard. And what is the governing standard? Whether the affiant had serious doubts about his averments in his affidavit, and whether there were obvious reasons to actually doubt the statements that were in the affidavit. That analysis, that language, doesn't even appear in the district court's decision. The district court made no analysis and no findings that the affiant had serious doubts, did not list any obvious reasons why the affiant would have doubted the statements in his affidavit. And looking at a decision even cited by the defendant from the Third Circuit, I've struggled to find case law from the D.C. Circuit where there was actually a finding of reckless disregard for the truth, and I have not been able to do so because it is such a high standard to go behind an affidavit and to challenge the statements that were in the affidavit that the judge in chambers relied upon in issuing the search warrant. Looking at the Third Circuit in the Brown decision, of which the defendant actually cited in his brief, the Third Circuit looked at the fact that that affiant, an FBI agent, made statements that were contradicted by the own witness statements that were provided by him by the investigating officer, a state trooper, relied on the fact that in that case, the state trooper testified that he did not communicate the fact that was set forth by the affiant in that case. And the Third Circuit focused on the fact that there was no justification in the record for the FBI agent's statement, a material statement, that the getaway car in that case had met up with the suspect's vehicle.
But wasn't the problem that once you decided those statements were false, what the court was really saying was that that meant that it was made up out of whole cloth and therefore reckless. So don't you have the same problem when you concede the falsity of these statements?
Your Honor, I would just say that the government has not conceded that the statements were false. The government assumes, for the purposes of this analysis, that they were false because the remedy the government is actually seeking in this case, reversal, can be achieved on two purposes. One, that the affiant didn't act with reckless disregard for the truth. And even if he did, the removing those statements that the district court found to be false, there would still be sufficient probable cause for...
Isn't Judge Brown's question, doesn't that make it harder on your first argument that you've conceded that they're false or mistaken? So on the touching of hands, I conceded or assumed arguendo, I'll put it in your terms, you've assumed arguendo that the hands didn't touch, and so there was a mistake in the affidavit. You've assumed arguendo. Doesn't that get you pretty far down the road of saying there's no other explanation for that other than the officer had disregard for the truth and putting that in there?
Your Honor, the government's position is that we're not conceding falsity. We're just shortchanging the analysis of whether it was true or false to ultimately get to the remedy we're asking for. The government is taking the position that because of the ambiguity in the statements, that the district court's finding did not meet the definition of clearly erroneous. The government is not conceding in its papers that the statements were actually false. If you look at the government's analysis of the recklessness nature, the government is basically saying that Officer Holland did not have serious doubts about his statements, and there were no obvious reasons to doubt that certain of the statements. For example, the Ziploc bags. Officer Holland...
But they weren't Ziploc bags.
Well, you're right. Your Honor,
knotted.
Your Honor, they were plastic bags that were tied in a knot. Officer Holland testified that in his practice, which is supported by the case law of jurisdiction, is that the most, including the District of Columbia, the more common form of packaging drugs is Ziploc bags. He did not say he never saw anything else but Ziploc bags used. He said it was more commonly used with Ziploc bags. In this case, the bags of the drugs that were found on the defendant, as well as the individual that he had had a communication with outside the vehicle and was ultimately in the vehicle, which he was a passenger, both had the same kind of packaging, which was the plastic bags tied in a knot.
Isn't the problem here that we have to find clear error to overcome the district court's decision?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's clear error.
That wasn't the case in the Brown case or anything like that. Is there a case where a court of appeals has found clear error with respect to a recklessness finding by the district court?
Your Honor, I am not aware of any district court, any decision of this court, binding authority by the D.C. Circuit.
Any court? Is there any time? You said you didn't find very many cases where it was found to be reckless. But are there any ones where a court of appeals has found clear error in a recklessness finding?
I cannot cite authority to.
It's not just that we disagree. We have to find that district court clearly erred.
Right, Your Honor, and the government's position is that there is no analysis of the recklessness issue. The district court said there was recklessness in abundance. We don't know what that means. We don't know if the district court found that one of the statements was so reckless that it tainted the truth or the actions of the affiant in regard to those other statements. There's no discussion whatsoever if the affiant actually entertained serious doubts about those statements. There's no list of what obvious reasons the affiant had for why the statements, in fact, why he should have known that the statements were, in fact, false. And if you look at the Third Circuit decision in Brown, the Third Circuit comes to two analyses as to why there was recklessness. One, there was nothing to justify the statement, nothing. The affiant in that case was contradicted by another officer who took the stand and contradicted by the witness statements that were provided to him by that officer, which the Third Circuit relied upon in saying that this statement made by the affiant in that case was, you know, pure imagination, came out of left field. In this case, we have Officer Holland relying on his experience, for example, in why Ziploc bags are more common. We have Officer Holland drawing from his conclusion that that when you have a betting sheet in the possession of the defendant, which identified bets being paid out, that's more consistent for managing and tracking of bets.
Before you run out of time, I want to ask you about why you think there's probable cause if all the statements are cut out.
Well, Your Honor, only two of the four statements pertain to drugs, and the appellee has basically conceded that by omission. And if you take the only two statements left, the packaging of the drugs and the hands touching, that doesn't negate the fact that the officers...
What is the evidence of probable cause?
Evidence of probable
cause... It has to be probable cause of distribution or possession with intent to distribute, right?
Yes.
That's what you claim. So what's the evidence of probable cause of a possession with intent to distribute?
We have drugs found on the defendant, yeah. Drugs found on an individual that the defendant was having a conversation with outside the vehicle, yeah. And also in the vehicle. The defendant had $2,600 cash on him. The defendant had three cell phones in separate pockets on his person. The defendant had...
The drugs, there's a marijuana cigarette. I take it there's not a claim that one was part of the distribution, correct?
No, but there was also marijuana on his person as well.
There was marijuana. He had marijuana on his person,
yes.
And the other person had four point three grams of crack,
yes,
in one bag.
Yes.
Right. So what is the theory of what happened?
The theory of what happened is that given that Mr. Cardoza has $2,600 cash on him, has three cell phones.
What's the theory of what happened? Just tell me what.
Is that Mr. Cardoza sold the drugs to the individual in the back of the
which
car?
Which drugs?
Yes.
Which drugs?
Which drugs?
So the marijuana really has no part of it. The claim is that this was a drug dealer who had no extra drugs on him of any kind. He wasn't distributing in the sense of he had a bunch of baggies filled with usable amounts of crack. He sold just one and didn't have any more with him?
Well, he had marijuana on his person and the joint that was underneath him.
But there's no claim of distribution of the marijuana or the joint, and no testimony by anybody that it was a distributable amount of marijuana, right?
No, but it was a distributed amount of cocaine.
We'll pause over that for one moment. But so far, you only have one piece. So this was the guy drove all the way to this place to deliver this one bag of crack. That's the claim?
Yes, and Your Honor, this is not a detached buyer. This is a distribution amount, so that distribution of cocaine could be broken down and sold. The theory of the government is this is a distributor.
Who's the distributor?
The defendant is distributing to a middleman in the chain of distribution.
Who do you think is going to break it down again?
It's going to be Mr. Unger, who then sell it on the street in smaller packets.
So do you know what your drug experts actually testify about? What's a distributable amount of cocaine? Crack cocaine? Does anybody actually testify now that less than 5 grams is a distributable amount of cocaine?
Well, the record that was before the court is that this was a quantity that was, I believe, in excess of an 8-ball that would be for distribution.
It was less than 5 grams. We have a case, the Stevens case, in which Stroud, who at that time was the expert, testified that 5 grams was an amount a junkie could use for personal use. Here we have it's only $400 to $500. It's sold in a pretty upscale neighborhood. What's the ground for believing that this wasn't just sold for personal use?
We have to take the totality of the circumstances.
So the totality of the circumstances is you claim that Adams Morgan is a high crime district where there's lots of distribution of crack?
No, that's not the government's position.
The government did put in testimony to that effect.
The government's
right?
position is that on the weekend hours in Adams Morgan, especially around 1 o'clock in the morning, that's an area for drug consumption and distribution.
And is Georgetown also? Would they testify? I'm wondering what area of the District of Columbia, if the corner of Columbia Road and Euclid is a common area for distribution, what area of Washington, D.C. isn't?
Well, Your Honor, that would be during a specific period of time.
So 1 a.m., there's a lot of people in Georgetown at 1 a.m. Is the idea that two people touching hands on Wisconsin and M in Georgetown, that's evidence enough for probable cause to believe there was a distribution there?
If that's by itself, no, Your Honor. But in this case, we have a false address, false current address provided.
Was it the address on his driver's license?
No, it was actually that he had a Maryland license on his driver's license. The search revealed only one current address as of that date, August of 2011. That was a D.C. address. We had the three cell phones. We had the...
Three cell phones for each person?
Three cell phones on one individual, Mr. Cardoz himself. We had money, $2,600 in separately packaged areas.
When you say separately packaged, that's not exactly right. Most of the money was together, and then there was an amount in his pocket.
Yes, there was $2,300 in one pocket. There was about $300 in another pocket. Your Honor, taking the totality of these circumstances, given the...
Let me ask, though. I would like to know, does the U.S. Attorney's drug experts now testify that 4.3 grams is an amount from which you can infer intent to distribute? Is that the standard testimony of drug experts now?
Your Honor, the government's not taking that position. Mm-hmm. The position that the government is taking, that when you took a look at all the circumstances...
But he did. That's what this officer, who's not a drug expert, but is in a vice unit, testified to. I just wonder whether that amount, the testimony is that amount is sufficient to infer distribution rather than for personal use when the value of it's only $450.
Yeah, and the government is not taking a position on that issue at this time.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, we'll hear from the defense. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Howard Katzoff on behalf of Jared Cardoza. Your Honors, we have argued and submit that Officer Holland did act with reckless disregard for the truth in fashioning the search warrant affidavit that he prepared, that the district court was not clearly erroneous, and that the district court's ruling should be affirmed. I'd like to talk a little bit about sort of the background and our position about the record and with regard to this. You have an August 27th, early morning hours, 1 a.m., arrest for simple possession of marijuana. The testimony is, and the indication is that the next day, Officer Holland had a theory that, for some reason, that Mr. Cardoza sold cocaine to the rear seat passenger. And he decided, consciously, deliberately, to sit down and craft a search warrant. And that process took about 3 days. At least we know that the search warrant wasn't signed until August 31st, so about 4 days later. This was not a rush process. This was not some emergency investigation. This was a pretty deliberate effort to construct.
Well, it's a deliberate effort to do the affidavit, but I'm struggling with where the evidence of reckless disregard for the truth is, even if we assume arguendo that there are a couple of mistakes in there. The hands were not touching when the affidavit said touching. Why do we assume reckless disregard? And I don't see the district court saying anything about reckless disregard as to the precise issues that we're talking about here.
Well, the district court made findings that there was reckless disregard.
In abundance, right?
In abundance.
Just a general statement, but not analyzing each statement, right?
And the district court went through each of the statements, and there was significant testimony. So, for example,
the testimony that it was wrong, and actually that's pretty thin to even assume that it's wrong, if you ask me reading this. But if you assume it's wrong, I see very little that suggests it was deliberately or even recklessly wrong as opposed to a mistake, and that's not good enough.
Well, I would beg to disagree.
That's why I'm asking the question, which is what are we relying on, or is your position just if it's a mistake, it must necessarily be a deliberate mistake? That's the way you were setting up your argument seemed to be that.
No, I wasn't setting up that if it's a mistake, that's what it was. Our position is if you fabricate, if the evidence ends up supporting the notion that out of whole cloth, he said, took bets as opposed to place bets. And the record here was very clear. There were, I believe, seven opportunities where the officer was asked at the hearing.
On the took bets thing, I'm confused by why the officer would have even had an incentive to put it that way and lie in that direction, because that would make it more likely that you're running a gambling operation. If you took bets.
Our view of this is that
if you're lying, if he actually said place bets and the officer lies and says took bets, that actually leads to a stronger conclusion that it was a gambling operation.
That's why he did it, and that's why the district judge found that it was a falsehood, and that's why the district court found that it went to the heart of.
That's a better explanation for why he has the money, not related to drugs.
I take it the theory of the affidavit was that it was one or both, and so there was evidence. If it was a gambling operation, the evidence of the operation would be in his house. Is that right? And if it was only he was only placing bets, there wouldn't be anything in his house that would be a crime. Is that the idea? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what is the difference between take and place. And I take it that if he only made bets, he was just a gambler and therefore wouldn't have evidence of running a gambling ring in his house. Is that your point?
The significance is what the district court recognized, and that is that this was a search warrant affidavit that in part, and we submit because it was so thin on facts with regard to drug trafficking, that he added the gambling section and put the admission in. And when he used the term took bets, he then and put the statutory language in, which he was asked about. He made it into a bookmaking operation with probable cause. What the district court said was, once I saw that, I barely even looked at the drug probable cause because I assumed, based on the admission of taking bets and the money that there was probable cause. Now, when we take that out of the mix, now we have to go back and look at the drug allegations. And the reviewing judge didn't have an opportunity to do that. So what he did by using the word took was to make a very strong search warrant.
So I take your point on that and makes it into a stronger gambling. Again, with the reckless disregard, you're assuming, I guess,
well,
that if it's mistaken, it has to be deliberate in that instance, or at least reckless.
If it's false and it wasn't said and there's no basis for it, and I think there's language like in the Wilson v. Russo decision, mm-hmm. and there's language in the Brown decision, where there is no basis for the words, the fabrication, the falsehood, then it's reasonable to infer that there was reckless disregard for the truth. And the totality of what the judge found in terms of recklessness, both on the gambling side, which the government has pretty much conceded that gambling is taken out of the picture. Mm-hmm. And gambling was only there because he used the word in his zeal to go get this search warrant. He said, took bets. When he was asked seven times with softball questions at the hearing, every time he said, without being tricked, without being coerced, he said he placed bets.
Then when he was asked by the judge specifically, he said took.
No, it wasn't that way. Actually, what happened is he had seven times.
The judge said
placed or took. He said placed. And after that, two more times, he said placed. Only when I really confronted him and after everybody talked about the problem with it, then he backtracked and said took. Now, in light of how clear the testimony seemed to be as to what that only placed was said, another factor the judge had to consider was the fact that he then backtracked and changed his testimony under oath to her, which she didn't believe.
So let's go.
And she said it was a bit cute, as a matter of fact, to say that some skillful lawyer or her asking skillful questions. That is not the way the record reads at all.
You don't want to object that there was a skillful lawyer involved.
I sent that to my mom and dad, but other than that, it's no bearing.
If we take out these statements, which is the government's alternative position, why isn't it enough for probable cause to the drugs, the cash, the cell phones, the false statement about the address, the prior arrests?
Well, the prior arrests, I would submit, the district court said they're really irrelevant. I would submit they're pretty much irrelevant. They were wrong. Other stuff, it's a stretch.
The arrests, I was a little unclear from the briefs. Is that in the end, the conviction was only for possession?
Possession, conviction.
There was no conviction for possession with intent?
There was no conviction, and there was only one arrest, and the we talked about that being incorrect, and it's not that big a deal really. But the bottom line is the arrests I don't think are much.
From a 404B point of view, why wouldn't an arrest for the equivalent of possession with intent to distribute be an element of probable cause?
Well, there was only a conviction for possession. And we don't really know a whole lot about the facts, so presumably there was only sufficient evidence for possession. Normally, that wouldn't be sufficient for possession with intent to distribute because it wouldn't go to show any of the normal mimic issues that would come into play. For probable cause, it's really taking a whole bunch of factors that, in certain circumstances, cases find support sufficiency of the evidence. That's the bulk of the cases that you get. And saying, well, the jury had enough evidence and could consider all these things. But really, in terms of establishing
the evidence is a higher standard, tougher for the government to meet than probable cause. Isn't that right?
It's just saying that we're not going to interfere with the jury's verdict.
Well, no, but the standard for us to uphold sufficiency is whether a reasonable juror could conclude. And probable cause is lower than that. Doesn't have to be a reasonable juror could conclude. Well, just has to be probable cause, which is usually defined lower than that, which is defined as lower standard than that.
That's true. But my point is that in all these cases, there are factors where there may be a cell phone, there may be money, but in every one of them, there is a very strong indication of drug distribution or drug trafficking, either based on informant information, based on personal observations of police, based on control.
Those are sufficiency for conviction. Here we're only talking about probable cause for a search. That's a lower standard, so you don't have to get all of that.
That's true, but there still has to be a fair probability that there's going to be drugs, and it generally relies on some sort of ongoing or repetitive activity, not a single possession of marijuana, which is all you have.
But you have the three cell phones and the cash and the marijuana and the cocaine.
Well, you have the cocaine associated with somebody else.
The theory of it, as Chief Judge Garland explored with opposing counsel, is that that was part of a transaction there.
Well, if we credit the judge's excising the portion of the affidavit, the judge excised the portion of them Mr. Unger and Mr. Cardoza being outside the car and having this exchange.
So
she actually read the whole quote and said that I find this to be false. And in part,
what would have been the grounds for finding anything other than the touch? I understand the argument about the touching, but what would have been the grounds for finding that coming close to touching or being near each other was false?
Part of the record is the Gerstein that was prepared on August 27th, which really has identical language about at such and such a time. It says the officers noticed that there were three individuals in a listed Toyota, front seat, rear seat driver. Due to this infraction, the officers decided to stop and make contact with the vehicle. That's what was said August 27th under oath. Three people in the vehicle.
That's all that was necessary for the arrest for possession, right?
That's correct.
So you wouldn't have needed to put in any more than that.
But if you're going to be truthful and accurate about whether you saw somebody outside the car when you first noticed the illegally parked car and decided to make contact, that would be the place to put it. In the affidavit in support of the search warrant, the same language says, your affiant observed, it says at approximately that 055 hours, the attention of the three officers was drawn to an illegally parked Toyota Camry. Your affiant observed defendants Unger and Cardoza standing on the sidewalk near the Camry, speaking to each other. That's in direct contravention. Both of them are under oath. And so the judge had that as well. And why she didn't say that, there was significant reasons in the record for her to perhaps have questions about the entire statement, because of this. You have two inconsistent sworn statements. Both of them can't be right. You can't observe a car with three people in it and decide to make a traffic stop, and in another one say, I observe a car with a driver in it and two people outside it.
Pause for a second. Where's the part where you think that the district court excised the whole encounter?
One second. That would be on...
I'm looking at JA 439, where the court is trying to decide what's left for probable cause. And the court says, if you take all the material that I find was included with reckless disregard, you end up with two men encountering each other on the street. That's not you end up with two people in a car with drugs. You find two people and men encountering each other. I don't see where it indicates that she wants to exclude the encounter itself.
That is inconsistent with the part that I refer to, which is at the Joint Appendix 429, where she reads the quote starting at your affiant observed defendants Unger and Cardoza standing on the sidewalk, and she read that entire portion when she ruled.
She says the next sentence, which explains what she found not to be true, says Officer Holland clearly testified he did not see the hands touch, and that what he saw had no significance to him at the time. I saw them reaching out with their hands towards each other. I was in the back of the car. I can't tell you exactly what they're doing. That doesn't sound like she's saying the whole encounter didn't take place. It's that she doesn't believe the hands part.
Well, I think most of her discussion was about that, to be quite frank. I thought it was
about the hands.
Yes.
Yes. So that wouldn't exclude. And then further down on the page it says he didn't see an exchange, he didn't see anything in their hands, he didn't see an object, he didn't see currency. But that it doesn't sound like what she's saying is that There was no, she just, that nothing outside the car was seen by the officers.
It wasn't clear to me, and I guess in light of the inconsistent two sworn documents, I treated the whole quote as being what she was excising in light of her discussion, and that's the reason I treated it that way. To be quite frank, if you take away what the district court found, that there was an attempt here to really mislead and suggest in the fleeting moment, as the officer described it, a hand-to-hand transaction which significantly colors and flavors the allegation. When you take away anything other than that being an Adams Morgan and being face-to-face and having a conversation, it really has no drug connotation. It's really a neutral factor.
I should have asked this on this part of the argument, but when you take away the gambling statements, doesn't that, what's the explanation for the cash?
Well, I haven't necessarily taken away the fact that, that the cash is gambling. That was Mr. Cardoza's position, that it was related to his gambling.
If you take but away the took bets statement.
It had nothing to do with illegal gambling. That's the difference. Not that it didn't have anything to do with gambling. It had to do with legal gambling,
right,
not illegal gambling.
Legal in the sense.
You're likely to have 2,800 if you're taking bets than if placing, but.
I mean, like it's legal to place the bets, but not legal to take the bets. Is that what you're saying?
I didn't say it's always legal to place bets, but in some circumstances, you can go to Las Vegas. You can go to Atlantic City. You can go a lot of places and place bets and do legal gambling.
But he wasn't in any of those places.
At that moment, he wasn't.
No, and he had a lot of cash on his hand. I can see if you caught somebody in a casino in Atlantic City with that much cash, I get your argument. But not at 1 a.m. in Adams Morgan. What's the theory there with respect to gambling? What was he doing?
Well, the theory is that it was money from gambling, and sometimes people have that kind of money from gambling.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much. Well, here, how much time does the government have left? Okay, we ate up some of your time. We'll give you 2 minutes.
Your Honor, in my limited time, I'd just like to respond to some points. As Judge Kavanaugh noted in questioning of the defendant, there's very little analysis whatsoever of recklessness. Addressing the issue of the hands touch, this court is absolutely correct. The district court did not excise the entire statement of the defendant and Mr. Unger being outside the vehicle, only the issue of whether the hands actually touched. And I would just note for this court that the district court, in its analysis of the testimony of Officer Holland, stated that I think Officer Holland has been as candid as he could possibly be in this courtroom, and his credibility I'm satisfied with in this courtroom. He put in his affidavit first that the hands touched, what I think he says now candidly is a bit of an overstatement. This is not an analysis of a...
I'm sorry, where is that?
That's at 213 in the record. That's the district court's actual analysis right after Officer Holland testified on this issue of the hands touched or not.
But it's not the final status conference
final decision.
No, it's not the final decision. It's her initial remarks after hearing the officer testify. Also, the issue of taking bets. The district court said at 434, I'm not comfortable with the accuracy of that statement. Again, there's no analysis whatsoever on the recklessness issue. What is the district court pointing to as to why it's obvious that the affiant didn't have a basis for his statement? The totality of the circumstances test in Illinois v. Gates requires a fair probability that the items to be searched for will be found at the location for the search warrant. Judge Garland questioned me on the issue of Adams Morgan. That's one issue, and I think you need to take into consideration all the circumstances in this case. You have what appears to be an interaction between two people, both which have drugs on their person. This is in an area, I would say, the period of time, the weekend hours, 1 o'clock in the morning, and the defendant has 20.
It doesn't really matter where it is, does it? I mean, that matters for the stop, maybe, but it could have been anywhere. And if you see two people exchanging things, and one has three cell phones and $2,800 and marijuana and cocaine, that's, you know, doesn't matter where it is, right?
I think that those are facts good enough itself are probably.
That's why the exchanging things matters, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think this court and other...
But you're willing to go ahead with the idea that their hands didn't touch, so we don't know whether there was an exchange or not.
The government is...
That element of the evidence, the physical viewing of the exchange.
The government, as I stated in my opening remarks, the government is presuming that that statement is inaccurate. That being said, we're not conceding it's inaccurate. The officer is testifying to what he observed 6 months later. He said very candidly, and the court used the word candidly itself in saying that the officer testified that, you know, he observed this transaction. But then you take into consideration the amount of money, the cell phones, the address that he provided, not in D.C., but a Maryland address that, according to the report that the government, you know, put forth into evidence, the only active address he had for that time was in D.C. All of these are factors.
So is the defense correct about the former prior arrests?
Your Honors, the defense is absolutely wrong, and I would point this court to JA 306 and 308. That's where at the trial level, the AUSA, the trial level, went through and showed that the report that the defense put in was a report that was 6 months after the underlying time of the arrest. And that's when the district court had ordered him to go back to Maryland and live at that address, and that's why there were two active addresses at that time. If you look, Judge Garland, at the actual report that the government put forth, there are check boxes for active addresses.
I'm talking about the arrests. I'm sorry. Arrest for possession with intent to distribute, as it turned out that those can't be relied on?
I would totally disagree. I think an arrest for possession with intent to distribute is highly relevant in an analysis. Now, ultimately, we don't know. Was it a plea bargain? Was it some agreement that the charge that ultimately he was convicted for was marijuana? We don't know. There's no inference, and there's no evidence put forth by the defense that the reason why it was only marijuana because it was lack of sufficiency of the government. It could very easily be his taking of responsibility, of which a lesser included just mere possession was ultimately dispositive.
Did the government know that the conviction was only for possession? Was the magistrate told that?
The magistrate was not told that. The officer relied upon the actual charging document. The officer did not represent that it was a conviction. He just represented that it was a charge for distribution. And I would also just very briefly, as my time is about to run out, in the packaging of drugs, JA 433, the district court talked about how the government had not presented any expert testimony at the Franks hearing that the Ziploc bags were more uncommon or bring photos of the evidence in. That's at 434. It's not the government's burden to establish recklessness. And also, Judge Garland, in response to your point, the government would take the position and a drug expert would testify that the quantity of cocaine found in the vehicle that the defendant was a passenger in would be sufficient for distribution.
What's the line that the experts take now? What wouldn't be sufficient? What? How many grams is not enough for distribution? You know, you don't know.
Your Honor, I would say obviously 3 grams would not be sufficient. I'm not a drug expert. I'm just arguing on behalf of the government here.
I understand. Okay, thank you. All right, we'll take the matter under submission. Mr. Katzoff, we appreciate your work as appointed counsel. And we appreciate your work as assistant U.S. attorney. Thank you.
Thank you.